He found this in manuscript form in India, in the archives, and republished it, edited it, and republished it. You know, so that has survived, you know, from that time. Anyway, Ibn Umar, 8 of his students wrote down hadith from him. Anas ibn Malik, 16 of his students had hadith in written form from him. Aisha bint Abi Bakr, 3 of her students had hadith in written form. Ibn Abbas, 9 of his students recorded hadith. Jabir ibn Abdullah, 14 of his students recorded hadith. Abu Sa'id al-Khudri, none of his students recorded hadith. Abdullah ibn Mas'ud, none of his students recorded hadith. But Abdullah ibn Amr ibn al-As, 7 of his students had hadith in written form. Umar ibn al-Khattab wrote many hadith in official letters. He didn't so much have students as he was the leader of the Muslim state. So what was conveyed from him, which people received, was the official letters, etc., which he wrote. Ali ibn Abi Talib, 8 of his students recorded hadith in writing. Abu Musa al-Ash'ari, some of his students were in the possession of, some of his hadith, sorry, were in possession of Abdullah ibn Abbas. In written form, he said it under Abu Musa al-Ash'ari. And al-Barra ibn Azib, he was also known to dictate his narrations to his students. So we do have some companions who didn't have students who wrote down, not that they didn't have any students, and they did narrate a number of hadith, but they were not in favor of writing of hadith. You know? So there were some companions who weren't. But the vast majority, out of these 12, really only 2 of them, 2 out of the 12, discouraged or didn't want anyone to write hadith from them. The reason for that was they either themselves, because one of them who didn't allow it, Abu Sa'id al-Khudri, he was the one who narrated the hadith where the Prophet ﷺ said, don't write down anything from me besides the Quran. Right? So he took that in the literal form, right, and he stuck by it. Abdullah ibn Mas'ud, his reason exactly was just that he preferred the students to learn from him through memorization. He favored the method of memorization, and that he felt that writing, you know, was too easy. It just made the gaining of knowledge too simple, so he preferred his students to memorize. But the vast majority of the companions, have said, they in fact had students who wrote down hadith as well as memorized, and these students in turn, they then conveyed the information in written form to the following generation. The generation after them, this is the fourth level, this is known as the tabi'ut tabi'in. Tabi'ut tabi'in, tabi' meaning follower or successor. Tabi'in, that is the plural form of tabi'. So it means the successors of the successors, or the followers of the successors, however you want to translate it in English. And this represents the final stage in the narration of hadith, where individuals were narrating from their own books, they had collections, or from the Sahaba. We have the Sahaba, we have their students, and we have the students of the students of the Sahaba. The students of the students, this represents the last link in the chain of transmission. From that point onward, you found now hadiths were collected into major collections and handed down more in the written form than in oral narration. From this period, we have the oldest work to have survived and been handed down to us, and that is Al-Muwatta. Al-Muwatta of Imam Malik, who was the Imam of Medina. And his grandfather was a Sahabi. His grandfather was himself a companion of the Prophet Muhammad. So, as you can imagine, the distance between the Prophet and what he narrated and those who made the final collections was not that far, though they refer to it as the second century. In fact, the Sahaba existed, a number of them existed almost to the end of the first century. And the second century, they had students, the Tabi'een, they were in the latter half of the first century, and they lived between the first and the second. So they really, the gap of time between Prophet ﷺ and the complete recording of his hadith, in fact, was very short. And we can, and has been stated, that the vast majority of the hadith were written down in the lifetime of Prophet ﷺ himself. They were handed in the time of the Sahaba to their students, and they continued to be in writing, but it just wasn't compiled into individual texts. It was really the generation of the Tabi'u Tabi'in, and the one which came after them, which they commonly call the generation of the Sahih, or the era of the Sahih. This is the third century. This is when you found the books of Sahih al-Bukhari, Sahih Muslim, Sunan Abi Dawood, and these books, came up. This is where the major writing took place. And the number of hadith narrations by this time were quite a lot. Imam Bukhari, for example, himself, his collection of hadith, contained 7,275 hadith. And this is with repetition. Actually, if you cut down those, because what he would do is, like, he would take a narration, he would narrate a portion of it in one chapter, and another portion of it in another chapter, with some overlapping, right? Because one portion was relevant to one issue, because he organized it according to headings, some of it relating to Islamic law, some of it relating to etiquette, etc. So his collection of some 7,275 narrations was extracted from over 600,000 channels of narration. So you see, the number of narrations had become quite huge. Not that the 7,000 was in fact the essence of those 600,000. There were some he chose and some he didn't. So his book, though he calls it the Sahih, that his attempt was not to gather all of the Sahih, but just a portion of it. And that's what he did in his collection. Now, if we look at this process from the point of view of the writing itself, as opposed to the point of view of the generations, the first first stage, which was within the first century, beginning after the Hijra, this is referred to as the stage of the Sahifa. The Sahifa. Sahifa meaning literally page, right? And their writing tended to be on pages of material. They're either goatskin, or they were, the type of material that were available for writing the Quran. Either where they were boughs of palm trees or shoulder blades of camels, etc., etc. The most popular one was, of course, parchment, because that could be folded up and carried more easily. If you have a bunch of shoulder blades, it gets kind of heavy. The second level, or period, or stage of writing, was called the stage of the musannaf, which literally means a classified or organized work. This covers the middle of the second century of the Hijra, after the Hijra. And this is includes the work of Imam Malik, and Muwatta is included in that stage of writing, the Musannaf. What you find in terms of Musannaf is that it may contain a variety of material. It may not just contain hadith, it may also contain the rulings of the Sahaba. It's kind of like a mixture. It wasn't really a hadith book as we come to know it later on. It contained rulings of the Sahaba themselves, or sometimes rulings of the Tabi'in, their students, were included in what were classified as the Musannaf. You know, in the Muwatta of Malik, you'll find all of that. The stage after that was known, and this was towards the end of the 2nd century, this was known as the stage of the Musnad, and of the hadith which we would call Musnad or collections, is the well-known Musnad of Ahmed. Musnad Ahmed, which contains some 40,000 hadiths, right? With some repetition. Removing the repetition may drop down to about 25,000 to 30,000. But the Musnads were organized according to alphabetical collections of the according to the names of the Sahaba. They would list the Sahaba and alphabetically, and then mention all of the hadith which this Sahabi narrated. So there were compilations based around the Sahaba themselves, their names, as opposed to basing them on topics, various topics. And the 4th stage of writing, which is considered the most important stage, is that of the Sahih, right? The Sahih of Bukhari. This began in the first half of the 3rd century and overlaps to some degree the period of the Musnad, you know. But this is the period now where the issues of authentication became great, and so the texts of compilations came to be referred to as Sahih, you know, and the Sunan. These are the 4 Sunan, well-known Sunan. These were compiled in this period. Now, what we're saying here, if we look back at the process of compilation of hadith, is that the hadith in general were not narrated merely orally. This is the main misconception which needs to be removed. That in fact, the vast majority of the hadith were narrated in writing. The vast majority, if not all. Very, very important. Because it is commonly quoted that writing of hadith didn't take place until the 2nd century. Idea being some 200 years after the time of the Prophet. But, and though there are references of this nature, that the major writing took place in the 2nd century, but you have to understand that when they're talking about the 2nd century, they're not talking about 200 years really after the time the Prophet died. The first century began with the Hijra. It included the last 10 years of the Prophet's life and included the lives of much of these companions. Many of them lived almost to the end of that first century. And they're the ones who actually heard the statements of the Prophet. So when you say that the major writing took place in the 2nd century, that is in the lifetimes of the students of the companions who heard and saw and related. So we're not talking about a huge gap of time at all. And as I mentioned, the vast majority of those companions who narrated, especially those who narrated large amounts, you know, more than 20 hadiths, the vast majority of them wrote down their hadiths. They wrote them down themselves, and they narrated it to students who also wrote down the hadith. So the process of writing began in the time of the Prophet. It was continued in the time, in the era of his companions, which overlapped with his own time, and into the era of the students of the companions, which overlapped into the era of the companions themselves, and then also after their time, after they passed away. And it was in that 2nd century, quote unquote 2nd century, that the major compilation took place. That is, gathering of it all. Not the writing. The writing, we said, took place from the time of Prophet ﷺ. But the actual compilation in now into the major works, like that of Al-Muwatta, and following it, Al-Musnad, you know, Musnad Ahmed, and the other Musnad, Masanid, is the plural of Musnad. And in the era which followed them, we find the major compilation into the well-known books that we know today. But the initial compilation, it took place really in the time of major compilation took place in the time of the students of the companions. And it was Omar ibn Abdul Aziz, right, who is known as the fifth righteous caliph. Sometimes he's referred to as the fifth righteous caliph. He is the one who gave the instructions for the hadith to be recorded, I mean, and collected, compiled. Right. And Az-Zuhri is known as the biggest figure of that era, who was the leading figure in the process of compilation. And we will be looking at this in our future sessions in more detail when we look at the actual process of transmission. How did the Sahaba pass it on? What was their methodology? What did they use? You said there was writing, but you know, what does this mean in terms of, did they hand their books over, or did they, you know, read these books, or did they have people read the books or whatever? We'll be looking at the methodology of transmission. This will be in our session tomorrow. As well as, you know, continuing with the historical process of the compilation. Okay, inshallah, we'll stop here. If you have any questions that you'd like to raise concerning the either the significance of hadith, which is what we covered in our first section, or the actual process of compilation of hadith themselves. Okay, our brother's question, you know, how do we harmonize or rationalize the two instructions of the Prophet ﷺ with regards to the writing of hadith? On one hand, he instructed companions, Abu Sa'id al-Khudri is the one who narrated the hadith, it's found in Sahih Muslim. He instructed that nothing besides the Quran should be written. And yet, on the other hand, we have Abdullah ibn Amr ibn al-As coming to the Prophet ﷺ, and the Prophet ﷺ is telling him that whatever I say is truth, so write it. How do we harmonize these two statements? As we said, that, and as the leading scholars generally concluded, that the statements of the Prophet ﷺ must be looked at in the context of his general practice. His general practice was to have people write down statements of his. We know from the letters, we know from other cases, other hadiths I mentioned where people asked the Prophet ﷺ, write this down for me, and they said, okay, write for Abu Shah, and so on and so on. You know, we have so many instances of writing, and the Sahaba saying themselves, we used to write in the time of Prophet ﷺ, so many cases, that it meant then that this instruction wasn't to be taken on face value, but it had to be looked at within a context, and that context was the writing of the Quran. That those people who were directly involved in the writing of the Quran, they were instructed by the Prophet ﷺ, perhaps initially, and then later that instruction was left, or it was a general instruction that in writing the Quran one should not write hadith along with it, and this was to avoid hadith being mixed up with Quranic text. Interpolation comes to be known as interpolation. So that's how the majority scholars took it. In fact, Imam Bukhari and a number of other scholars of his time, they took the position that this hadith, right, which ended up being transmitted as a statement of Prophet ﷺ, was actually a statement of Abu Sa'id al-Khudri himself, which later, as it was handed down, and he didn't have anybody write, it got mistakenly quoted as a statement from Prophet ﷺ himself. The position held by Imam Bukhari. Of course, this is, I mean, it's arguable. Was it just the case or was it not the case? I mean, the fact that there were so many other narrations where he gave instructions to write, this does tend to point to the fact that this may in fact be the case. But if those who have narrated and handed it down were among the highly respected narrators of hadith, you know, then we have to take it on faith rather than in fact it was a statement of Prophet Muhammad.
Your question?
When you mentioned graves and mosques, and you saw that very different prophets where they died, and then some of the Romania Empire expanded the mosque included. Can you explain that just from a woman who understands what's going on?
Okay, brother, just asking for further clarification on how the Prophet's grave became included in the masjid, in his masjid. As I mentioned, the wives, the homes of the wives of the Prophet were on the left side of the masjid. They were on the left side of the masjid. They each wife had a one room or one and a half room apartment, and the door opened right onto the masjid. So he would leave the home of his wives and walk straight into the masjid. Okay? And after his death, when he was buried in Aisha's home, in the time of Omar radiallahu anhu, he did expand the masjid, but he expanded it to the other side. To the right side as opposed to the left side. And there were other homes, people's homes were very close, right up next to the masjid. In fact, you still have, if you go to Masjid al-Nabawi, certain doors are called Bab Omar. Huh? Why? Because that was where Omar's home used to be. He used to leave his home and go to the masjid also. They had built their homes right next to the masjid. Okay? That's why you still have the names after some of the companions. Anyway, those homes were torn down and the masjid was expanded to the right. It was expanded eventually towards the Qibla, increased, and that's why you find two mihrabs in the masjid. If you look at Masjid al-Nabawi, you'll have a mihrab where they have the green rugs, which they call the rawda. There's a mihrab, that's concave niche where Imam may stand and pray. And then you have another one farther forward, right, where people line up, where the Imam actually now stands and prays. And that's because of the expansion which took place. And people have maintained the location of the original mihrab of the Prophet ﷺ. Of course, in the Prophet ﷺ's masjid, there was no mihrab. Right? This was added later. And they maintained that location because of the statement of the Prophet ﷺ in which he said, what is between my home and the minbar is from the gardens of paradise, right? And that's why they call it Rawda. Rawda meaning a garden. So during the lifetime of the Sahaba, no expansion took place on the left. But after the time of Muawiyah, actually it was not even the time of Muawiyah, who was the first of the Umayyad dynasty, but after his time, in the time of Abdul Malik ibn Marwan, he instructed the governor of Medina to make the expansion on the left side also. And Sa'id ibn al-Musayyib, who was one of the leading tabi'een or successors, students of the Sahaba at the time, he was there in Medina and he instructed them not to do this because they were now creating a situation which the Prophet ﷺ had prohibited, but they went ahead and did it anyway. And this is why during the Umayyad period, you know, after the time of Muawiyah and the rulers after that, many of the Muslim scholars left the centers where the rulers were, because of the fact that they were incorporating practices, etc., which were un-Islamic, you know, and they didn't want to be in a position of having, you know, a compromising position of having to be quiet when they were doing some of these things, so as not to bring on themselves the wrath of the rulers. So that expansion took place, as I said, during the time of Abdul Malik ibn Marwan. And they did place, even when they did it, they still placed around it a kind of diamond-shaped wall, you know, three sides. And they put it, you know, in such a way that people, if they wanted to try to face the wall directly, you know, they would be away from the Qibla, so that people wouldn't line up and appear to be praying towards the Qibla, but they were in fact praying towards the grave. They deliberately did this. Later on, you know, other, in the time of the Ottoman Turks, and that they put around it a cage, which is what we see now, that brass cage, draped, green cloth was put over the house of Aisha, and the brass cage was put around it, you know, sealed, and that now it's back in a format which a person could stand behind it and appear to be praying in the direction of Qibla when they're actually in fact praying to the grave. Okay, brother's question, it's not permissible, but it's still there today. In fact, in many parts of the Muslim world where they end up burying, you know, righteous people or people they consider to be righteous saints, whatever, in the masjid, basically in Pakistan, I think I could hardly find a masjid that didn't have a grave in there, someplace. Most of the masjid I visited in Pakistan had a grave there, right? Maybe some of them were, you know, in the Qibla area. Some of them were in the courtyard outside of the masjid, you know, which was still a part of the masjid because people prayed in the courtyard. But, you know, people, when these issues are raised, they say, but Medina, you know, if it was good enough for Prophet Muhammad Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, it's good enough for us, right? You know, sort of attitude. But of course, this is based on ignorance. They didn't know how the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam grave got in there. But the question is, why wasn't it removed? It remains there. Well, this has to do with politics. Strictly politics. It has nothing to do with the deen. It has strictly to do with politics. Because even the green dome, which we traditionally see, which is placed right over his grave, actually the green dome is a structure built over his grave, that according to Islamic law should be destroyed and removed. But it has now become the symbol of the Masjid of Medina, unfortunately. But the point is that, okay, when the followers of Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab and the family of Saud took over Arabia, took over Mecca and Medina, they did begin a process of purification. All of the trees, there were trees and things which people had believed were places of barakah. People were going there to the trees and making special du'as there and prayers there, and all these trees which are supposed to be for Bay'atul Ridwan, you know, which actually Omar had already cut down, so it didn't exist. So people had invented another tree and said this was the one, you know, and the house of Prophet ﷺ's parents in Mecca, all these kind of structures were there, and they went and they destroyed all of these things, right? They went into the graveyards of Medina and Mecca, which by that time looked like cities, because people had built so many structures over it, you know, domes and virtual little minarets, mini minarets and things that is inside there. They look like literally towns. If you see pictures of the graveyards from that period, they went in, they leveled everything. They leveled all the graves, you know, even with the ground. When they did that, like the Taliban, the Taliban went and took out the Buddhas, you know, the whole world screamed. Ignorant Taliban, you know, look what they're doing, it's not from Islam. Similarly, when they leveled all these graves, you know, the Muslim world, which were used to building structures over their graves, and when they, especially those which were built over the grave of Fatima and all these others there, yeah, this was a big, big crime. They said, look at these Wahhabis, you know. And of course, Wahhabi then became like an evil apostate who is trying to destroy Islam. That was the name Wahhabi came to mean. But in fact, it was people who were, they referred to them rather Puritans. They wanted to go back to the pure Islam. They were fundamentalists. They wanted to practice Islam as it was taught by Prophet Muhammad, but not as it had become culturally defaced and distorted, you know, over the many generations. So after they did that and the Muslim world screamed, then for them to go and remove the grave from the masjid and tear down the green dome, they were, politically they felt it wasn't wise to do it at this point in time. Because, you know, what would happen? What was the consequence? And the Muslim world would send armies in there, you know, to go and the Muslims, right? So they didn't do it. And nobody has had the nerve to do it since then. And of course, it has to come from the leadership. It has to come from the leadership. I mean, you as an individual can't go there and decide you're going to start tearing down the walls of the masjid, right? I mean, the Muslims themselves, you know. You're on record. Well, you know, the point is that the best way for it to be dealt with, you know, is to be dealt with through the leadership.
Yeah.
You know, this is the best way. Because, you know, if it were done, you know, as a guerrilla action, as you're suggesting, then what would happen is that those in authority would just go and build it back. You know? They would build it back because the same reason why it's there is the same reason why they build it back. So you just be, you know, defeating your purpose, really. So the best thing is just to leave it until such time as we have the kind of leadership that is firmly grounded in the Quran and the Sunnah as understood by the Sahaba to correct it, or, you know, to the time of the Mahdi. If that's when it has to be done, well then, you leave it till then. Abdul Malik ibn Marwan. For the question, any questions from the sisters, they can...
It's related to the same thing. Since we have all the faith through the Prophet, also in Muslim Islam, we have
okay, brother's question, you know, if we are instructed not to pray to the Prophet or through him, then what of these prayer maps that we have with pictures of the masjid on it, right? Masjid and Nabawi, yeah, in many cases. Well, it's not good. It's really better if we're going to use a prayer mat, it should be plain, really. Prophet ﷺ discouraged anything which would distract us, would catch our attention, distract us in the prayer. So it is preferable that the prayer mat be plain, you know? And in fact, by putting these pictures, the Kaaba or Masjid Nabawi, we are misinforming others about who we worship. Because those people who think that in fact we may be worshipping the Kaaba or the Mosque in Medina, and this is confirmed. Here we are. We have these rugs with the Kaaba and the Mosque. Right? Just like they will worship their idol, either in a physical form, the actual idol they keep at home, or they have a picture. You know, they have a picture of Ganesh, and they do their little worship around Ganesh picture. You know, it's just as good as, not quite as good, but almost as good as doing it with the idol itself. Right? So, we actually contribute to the misunderstanding of people about Islam by producing these colorful prayer mats with pictures of the Masjid in Nabawi and the Kaaba on them. And they're really not in keeping with Islamic tradition. Okay. Brother's question concerning repeated narrations of hadith, for example, like in Sahih al-Bukhari. He asked whether these are discarded. No. What we're dealing with here is that a hadith may address more than one issue. A hadith may have in it statements more than one issue. Prophet ﷺ oftentimes said things, you know, people were asked about one thing, and he would answer about more than one. You know, he would give further, you know, depth to the, in the answer to the question that was directed to him. So what happened then is that a repeated hadith may be put under one, more than one heading. Maybe it's put under 2, 3, 4 different headings, because there are different aspects of it that are relevant to the different subjects. For example, the hadith concerning Dajjal. Okay? Hadith concerning Dajjal of the Antichrist is generally put in the under the heading of signs of the last day, right? The final hour, things connected to the last day. But in the same time, Prophet ﷺ had said that the Dajjal would rule for 40 days. The first day would be equivalent to 1 year. So the companions asked, right, will 5 prayers suffice for that 1 day that's like a year? People who live in areas where you have 6 months of sunlight, 1 day, 6 months long. So they asked, will 5 prayers suffice then? We said, no, you have to estimate it, estimate for it. So that hadith, though initially it comes under the heading of signs of the last day, it has implications in terms of prayer timings and estimation of prayers in circumstances where it is necessary to make some estimation. So it can be put under 2 different headings. On what? What do you mean, on what basis will they record it? Okay, in terms of the basis under which hadiths were recorded and identified, classified, etc., this is coming. This is part of the course. One section will be on hadith classification. On what basis do we say a hadith is sahih? Do we say that it is, which is authentic, highly authentic, and do we say it is da'if, not authentic? What is the basis?
Right.
We touched the foundations of it in our second level of our course, but now we'll be looking at it in more depth. Okay, again, you're jumping the gun. A question concerning profiles or biographies of the hadith narrators. Where did this come? Where it is found? They're found in books known as Kutub al-Rijal, or the biographical works, your works which have been compiled on the various narrators. And in fact, the information about these various narrators was handed down along with the narration of the hadith. Okay, the total number of Sahaba different estimates have been put, you know. The high estimate is something like 100,000. High estimate. Others are less than that. The 60s, 40s, 80s. Yeah, all that is included as a Sahabi. They may have just met him one time, accepted Islam at the time of that.
Yes.
majority of hadith, question about the vast majority of hadith, were narrated in written form. They're written down. They're written down. A channel of narration represents a chain of narrators carrying a particular statement of the Prophet. It may be from a single Sahabi, but each one of his students and the student's students, each one of them represents, or each grouping represents, a channel of narration of that statement of that Sahabi. I should mention that besides the fact that, you know, it was in that third generation, the Tabi'ut Tabi'in, that the major writing took place, that those three generations had a special place in the sight of the Ummah from the point of view that Prophet ﷺ had said, خَيْرُ النَّاسِ قَرْنِي ثُمَّ الَّذِينَ يَلُونَهُمْ ثُمَّ الَّذِينَ يَلُونَهُمْ. The best of people are my generation, then those who follow them, then those who follow them. So special status was also given to the hadith, the narration of hadith in those first three generations. And of course when Prophet ﷺ said that, Allah knows, he didn't mean specifically that they would be the ones that would do the major recording of the hadith, but that's what it turned out to be. And in this is obviously his statement of them being the best of generations is based on a revelation from Allah. For him to make that claim, it has to be a revelation from Allah. And in fact, they did play a major role in the protection of Islam. And that those first three generations are generally referred to by the term Salaf. Salaf meaning pious predecessors. And so you may hear the term Salafi, you know, person says, I'm a Salafi, meaning I follow the Quran and Sunnah as it was understood by those first three generations, because they best understood Islam.
Just now mentioned about this 1,015 Sahabas actually narrating the actual number of Sahabas being almost minimum limited to 50,000. This 1,000 is a very small number compared to the world of people. So is there any reason of conflicts or the check coming up into Islam because of some people taking some other narrators and being not considered amongst the 1,000?
Okay, brother is asking why. If the total number of Sahaba may have been anywhere between 50,000 and 100,000, why only 1,060 of them narrated hadith? Well, there is a well-known statement of Prophet ﷺ, مَنْ كَذَّبَ عَلَيَّ مُتَعَمِّدًا فَلْيَتَبَوَّعْ مِقْعَدَهُ مِنَ النَّارِ. Whoever tells a lie about me deliberately to take his seat or sitting place in the hellfire. Right? Hadith is narrated by many, many, many companions. Well known. Prophet ﷺ repeated this on a number of occasions. He warned against fabrication. Actually, in the narration of that same hadith of Abu Sa'id al-Khudri, where Prophet ﷺ said, don't write anything other than the Quran, in the end of that narration he says, and whoever lies about me will find his sleeping place in the hellfire. It's mentioned actually in that narration. So the companions were very wary about narrating anything which may be doubtful, you know, maybe they forgot or whatever. So only those who are absolutely sure that what they were conveying was in fact what the Prophet ﷺ said, he did, or he approved. They're absolutely sure. Only those who were absolutely sure narrated. So that shows really the care and concern the companions had to avoid, you know, false information being conveyed about or from the Prophet Muhammad ﷺ. Okay, you are jumping the gun. But I was asking about the differences between Hanafis and Shafis, you know. This is jumping the gun. We will look into that as we look into more into the hadith, the application, etc. Further questions? Not? Okay, we'll close. Subhanakallahumma wa bihamdika, nashhadu an la ilaha illa anta, nastaghfiruka wa natubu ilayk. And